I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, I am going to talk to Jennifer Howd. Her first book is called Sit, Walk, Don't Talk, How I Survived a Silent Meditation Retreat. And here at Words on a Wire in the studios at KTEP, we tend to get a lot of books to be considered for our show. And I'm not sure what it was that grabbed my attention on this book. I think perhaps it's because as a writer, I think that it's very difficult to separate our spiritual, mental, and intellectual development from our artistic development. I think a writer always needs to develop, because if you quit developing as an artist or a writer or even a human being, I think you begin to fall into old models of self and you begin to repeat yourself. And I think the worst kind of inertia, intellectual, artistic inertia, leads to becoming a parody of your own work, which we see, I've seen happen to some writers. But most of the writers that we admire are writers that spend their entire life developing. And so I'm thinking this idea of silence, meditation, and of this kind of development is intimately linked to our creative development. So as a writer, I'm incredibly interested in this subject, and I hope you are too. Jennifer Howd, author of Sit, Walk, Don't Talk, How I Survived a Silent Meditation Retreat, will talk to us about going to one of these meditation retreats and what it means to her. And we'll think about what it means to a writer. So stick around. Jennifer Howd is a writer, editor, and a mindfulness facilitator. She is certified to facilitate mindfulness through UCLA's Mindful Awareness Research Center. She is co-author of The Gay and Lesbian Guide to College Life, and this is her first monograph. And monograph is a term we use a lot here at the university. It means, as you know, this is her first book that she wrote entirely on her own, not with a co-author, and it's called Sit, Walk, Don't Talk, How I Survived a Silent Meditation Retreat. Jennifer, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
And where you're in Los Angeles right now, some part of L.A.?
Yes, what, I am in Los Angeles.
Which part of Los Angeles do you live in?
I live in Atwater Village. Do you know where that is?
Yeah, isn't that kind of close, a little north of Hollywood, I think? Or kind of north, northeast of Hollywood? Yeah, it's a nice community. And I imagine that in that community there are a lot of opportunities to seek a spiritual practice outside of the confines of conventional religion.
Absolutely. Yeah, L.A. is kind of a gift in that way. There's so many different pockets of awesomeness happening in this town that are just a little bit left of center.
Yeah, absolutely. I lived in Venice Beach for a year about 3-4 years ago. And the opportunities to attend lectures about, you know, spirituality from so many different perspectives. And I know there's even a secular church there somewhere. I forget the name of it, regular church services on Sunday, only it's secular and it's just all about love. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you're a transplant from New York, though. You went from New York to Los Angeles. How was the transition in terms of the spiritual noise that must have been going on in your head at the time?
Oh, my goodness. Wow, kind of worlds apart. And honestly, you know, when I was living in New York, I lived in New York for about 16 years prior to moving to L.A. I did not have a practice in place when I was there. Mm-hmm. I was interested in the subject. I was doing a ton of reading about it. But I wasn't really doing much practice. I kind of dipped my toe in and out of it. And when things got, you know, I dipped my toe in and out of it when life was, like, really challenging. But then when I got my stuff together, I kind of stepped out of it again. And I just kind of seesawed like that for many years there. So then I moved to L.A. and my life fell apart. And I got to a point where I was just like, okay, I need to get serious about some sort of practice that has a spiritual note to it. And I got into secular mindfulness and kind of took off from there. And it was a very, you know, I don't know if I would have gotten into it in the same degree if I were still living in New York, to be honest with you. I'm not sure. Good question.
Yeah, and so the result of your practice, your conversion, your transformation, at least one of the results, because I'm sure there's multiple ones in that we're going to hear a lot from you in the next many years. But one of the first results is sit, walk, don't talk, how I survived a silent meditation retreat. What was the impulse for you to write this book?
Funny, I was on retreat. I was going through a program at UCLA's Mindful Awareness Research Center, and one of the requirements was to go on retreat. And I had been on one 5-day prior to this one that I ended up writing the book about, but I went on the retreat for the requirement for the class. For the program, and I just had this really crazy kind of experience, really crazy and wild internal experience, right? Because it's a silent retreat, so it was, certainly wasn't external, but the stuff that was going on in my mind was just kind of insane, and I was dealing with a lot of pain. I won't give the spoiler alert, but I was dealing with a lot of pain, which exasperated all of the internal strife that I was going through. And so I came back from that retreat, and several of my friends were kind of like, hey, what was it like? And I had so much stuff that went on. I was like, all right, let me just write an email, kind of a mass email to folks to just get it out there so I don't have to say it over and over and over again. And I started writing the email, and about, 35 pages into it, I was like, wait a minute. I think this is a book. That's really kind of how it started. Yeah.
That's amazing. And that says a lot about actually the readability and the tone of this book. It's very honest, very straightforward. But the fact that the first draft was an email, that's incredible. Because you were telling it to people that you cared about, and you were telling them about it because you cared about them.
Exactly.
So tell us, what exactly is a meditation retreat? And you specifically say in the book that this one is a Vipassana meditation retreat. Can you explain those terms?
Sure. The term is actually Vipassana.
Vipassana. Sorry, I can't read my own writing.
That's okay. Vipassana, it's also known as insight meditation. And so, there are several centers in the United States, actually everywhere, but I've only specifically gone to ones in the United States that that offer these retreats. And in the insight tradition or Vipassana tradition, it stems from a Buddhist tradition. Mm-hmm. Some places are more secularized than others. And there's kind of a spectrum of that.
Right.
And I'm more drawn to the more secular, less super Buddhist-y kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so I've been to a place called Spirit Rock up in Northern California. There's another large center in Massachusetts, Insight Meditation Society, IMS, that's mm-hmm. kind of on par with them, that Jack Kornfield is the founding teacher of, and he might be a name that some folks are familiar with. But anyway, it stems from that, and essentially what you do is you go away for a certain amount of time, anywhere from a weekend to, months. Some people do year-long and longer retreats. But you go and you go with a group of people, and there are typically teachers who help to hold the container of silence, and you don't talk. you are completely in your own experience. And part of that, it's called noble silence. Part of that experience also is no nonverbal communication with people. Mm-hmm. So you're not looking at people in the eye. You're having your own experience, and you're allowing everybody else to have their own experiences without, the pressures of social cues being there to really allow you to be completely fully with yourself. And so you typically meditate, starting very early in the morning, from about anywhere between 4:30 and 5, 6, somewhere around there they start. And you sit for about 30 to 45 minutes, sometimes up to an hour at a time at certain places. And then you have a period of walking meditation for the same amount of time. And then you kind of alternate back and forth and back and forth with breaks for meals. And then at some point during the end of the day, there's usually some sort of discourse from a teacher on a topic that's related to meditation or mindfulness in some way. And then you go to bed and you start the whole thing the next day.
Wow. Wow. You know, I can't help but think of, as you're talking about this idea of not communicating with others, and I imagine going on Facebook is completely looked down upon in that experience.
Yeah.
But I can't help but think of that quote that you always, exists in the popular culture. I mean, I think it's quoted often about all of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone, which is from Pascal. But of course, we would say all of humanity's problems stem from a person's inability to sit quietly alone in a room. And I think that the source of that struggle, that inability to sit quietly alone in a room without turning on the TV or without picking up your smartphone, is you begin to hear your voices, and that's sometimes competing voices. Can you tell us about your experience with these? Like I guess there's a difference between the voice that is deeply within, the voice that connects you on a sublime level to everything. You feel connectedness, and not so much an audible voice, but that voice that is deep inside, and the voice that keeps telling you things, like a voice that would keep telling me, "Chacon, you're making the wrong decision. Quit doing this." Can you tell us about that struggle?
Yes, absolutely. And for me, I can kind of think about them in terms of, that deep inner listening is more language of the heart versus language of the mind, which is tends for me at least to be very critical and very judgmental.
Right.
And I share in the book, I give voice to both, actually. I give voice to both. The more mind-oriented critical voice is all in caps and is generally whining, moaning, complaining, judging. Doing all of those things. And then the other part, kind of once I am aware that the judgmental voice, or the inner critic, another way of putting it, is speaking, with my practice, I've been able to get a distance from it. And, before I used to believe that's who I was, right?
Right,
and I didn't
right.
realize I had a choice to actually not listen to that voice. I can choose not to do what it's telling me, when it's speaking. And so exercising that muscle through the practice of mindfulness, I've been able to, again, distance myself from that and not just get swept up in whatever it's telling me, which has then let me create space for the heart voice to kind of emerge and bubble up. And that voice is always really, it's very calm. It's very loving. It's very compassionate. It's very patient. It sees things much more clearly. And I can then choose to listen to that voice and act from that place instead.
It sounds a lot like you're saying that whether we're conscious of it or not, we are our thoughts.
People tend to believe that, yes. But what happens with this practice is you realize you don't have to be your thoughts. And you can choose which ones that you end up expressing.
And so there's the language of the heart, and the other one you said was the language of the voice, right?
Of the mind.
Of the mind, yeah, of the mind.
Yeah.
And that's the one that can be the critical voice.
Yes,
and
for sure.
Do both of them use syntax? Do both of them use the same kind of language? And if so, how do you distinguish between one or the other? I mean, I suppose that's part of the practice.
That's such an interesting question. I never pondered that before, but my answer to that is really it's more of a feeling that is associated with the thought.
Mm-hmm.
Also noticing kind of a tone. We're talking in kind of writer's terms, like the tone of the mind and critical, like the inner critic, is really harsh, very quick to jump on things, to judge things, kind of snappy, and it doesn't feel good when those thoughts are racing around my mind, right? I feel anxious, I feel angry, I feel frustrated. Those are the emotions that are generally associated with that character in my mind.
Right.
And the other one is really much, much calmer, soothing, gentle, relaxed.
Yeah, because, you know, the fact is, if there's two voices, the voice of the mind and then the voice of the heart, and I completely agree and I completely understand where you're going, but just I want to just clarify it a bit. Oftentimes, the voice of the mind can be soft and that can be soothing, but oftentimes we can mistake that voice as well, maybe perhaps from a voice that doesn't perhaps use language. But then there's that other way of feeling some connection, something beyond yourself that doesn't really have syntax, but that is just, you know, without form. Because I think energy without specific form is a much closer connection to the source.
Yeah. And you know, the word love just, you know, just came to me as you were talking about that. That's really the difference. Like, is the energy of the word carrying love?
Right.
And if it isn't for me, then I am pretty sure my mind is trying to convince me of something, you know.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, I suppose that you know, you started with this retreat and you wrote a book about it. You know, every day you have all the days listed here and some really wonderful examples of how you and by extension we can really argue with ourselves and struggle with our thoughts, and all of it took place in Joshua Tree.
Yes.
How did the environment of the desert? Some people don't know what Joshua Tree is, but it's outside of Los Angeles. But what, about a 2-hour drive?
Yeah, that's about right.
And it's a really spiritual place. A lot of people go there to just do retreats, you know, like you did. I have a friend who lived in L.A. who would go there, stay in a tent for 2 days and just communicate with himself. And, I mean, how did that landscape affect the overall experience?
Well, that's another good question I hadn't really pondered before. But I think that just the open spaciousness of it and the stillness that exists along with the heat. There's something in the alchemy of all of that that really is quite conducive to diving deeper inward, you know.
Right.
In the city, like where I live, you know, in LA, there's stuff going on everywhere, noises and people and blah, blah, you know, and it's very easy to get swept up in, again, in the kind of judgmental mind or whatever the mind is talking about, and to stay in that space, but to drop down into the heart, you really need a container, you know, and the retreat itself creates that for you, but the environment where the retreat is happening also absolutely influences, as you just mentioned.
Yeah, and in the desert, the horse has no name, you know,
yeah.
And the name gives meaning, and sometimes not the right meaning to things. I'm talking with Jennifer Howd, author of Sit, Walk, Don't Talk, How I Survived a Silent Meditation Retreat. It's a wonderful book about her experience going into a retreat. And Jennifer, you have this wonderful passage about confronting a future version of yourself and almost as if you were watching the older version of yourself, the one that came to the retreat, as if you were watching that one say goodbye and the other one say hello. But there's this really wonderful moment of compassion that the future self has on the present self. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Sure. So this was, I have to remember now because this was many years ago.
So this was day 7, which was really wonderful because 7, which is such a perfect number, was on your birthday as well. And this is when you said goodbye to your former self and hello to your future self, or became your future self.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, you know, it really just kind of was this spontaneous kind of vision of being with myself, you know, like at 39 and kind of sitting with all of the experience that I had had up until that point, all of the really challenging things mostly that were coming up, and then just feeling a certain appreciation and honoring that person who brought me to the retreat and got me to the seat that I was in when I was having that experience, and just stepping into this new version of myself, this kind of more mindful, more present, more conscious version of myself that really loved myself in a way that the earlier version of myself didn't really take that much care for. And so I had this vision of really just kind of seeing myself swap out, where I like hugged the old version, hugged the new version, and then they kind of switched places, and then I saw the old version kind of walk away, and I was then left with
Nice.
With who I am now. And yeah, it was really a beautiful moment.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like, you know, all the days, you know, that led up to that were necessary in order to have that transformation. I'm wondering, are you in that future self right now as you're talking, or do you go back and forth into that future self and retreat into the former at times?
Mm. Yeah, I am absolutely living my life primarily from that future self that I'm referring to. That's where I am now. And for sure, I have moments where I'm reminded of and momentarily stepping into the prior version of myself. Uh-huh. But again, with this practice, I'm able to recognize it very quickly and step back into the version of myself that I'd rather be instead.
And you just got back from another retreat recently.
I did, yeah.
And is it important to continue the practice in order to continue the journey?
For me, it is. Absolutely. I go yearly at this point for at least 7 days, usually is my minimum now. It's like a, you know, it's a booster shot for my practice. And it really just helps me get to depths of myself that I'm not really able to get to in my daily meditation practice of, you know, 45 minutes a day.
you meditate for 45 minutes a day?
I do.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I imagine sometimes it feels more completely centered than other times. Like maybe.
Oh, absolutely.
I try to do 10 minutes a day. I'm a novice, right? I try to do 10 minutes a day. And I tell you, I cannot empty myself of thought. Are you able to empty yourself pretty effectively of thought for those 45 minutes?
Well, that's the thing. I'm glad you brought that up. Most people think that they can't meditate because they can't stop thinking.
Uh-huh.
And that's the thing with this particular type of meditation, mindfulness meditation. You're not actually trying to stop thinking. You're not trying to empty yourself of thought.
Wow.
What you're doing is you're building new relationships with your thoughts and learning how to manage them in a different way. So you're not trying to stop thinking.
Oh, that's nice. Can you give me an example on that? I love that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. So an example of the technique is like you're sitting and you're focusing, you know, typically you're focusing on an anchor point, like the sensation of the breath in the body. And so you're focusing for maybe like a couple breaths, and then all of a sudden you think about how you have, you know, a writing assignment due tomorrow and you haven't even started yet, right?
Right, right.
And you start noticing, oh, I'm feeling really anxious. So what happens is you first thing you notice is, oh, I've pulled my attention away from my anchor point. My attention is no longer on my breath. It went to this thought, right? And now you just say in your mind, thinking. So you acknowledge that the thought showed up, and you just say, you label it. It helps to kind of label it with a neutral word like thinking. And then you disengage your attention from it, and you guide your attention back to the meditation anchor point.
It sounds very non-judgmental.
Yes, exactly. That's the point. You're not trying to push it away. You're not trying to make it bad.
No.
You're not trying to grab onto it either, because there'll be some thoughts that are really great that you want to like really indulge in. But you just notice the tendency to want to indulge in it. You notice what's there. You're like, okay. And then you go back to your meditation anchor point. And that process of bringing your attention from the focus point, noticing the thought, disengaging from the thought, coming back, that cycle helps to build the quote-unquote mindfulness muscle, which really is helping you build focus and awareness.
What is an anchor point? Can you give us an example of various anchor points?
Yeah, so the sensation of the breath in the body can be used as an anchor point. So if you're just sitting, you notice if you're breathing through your nose, what it feels like to breathe through your nose. You might feel some sensation or maybe coolness on the nostrils, right? So you just focus on those sensations in the body as opposed to anything else that might be going on for you. And you keep that as your kind of focal point and what we're calling anchor point.
And does the anchor point, is it rooted in the body or can it be an image?
Well, for mindfulness meditation, it is generally rooted in the senses. So it can also be sound that's outside of your body, you know, environmental sounds. It can also be neutral sensations in your hands or feet. Those are other typical typical anchor points. There are other forms of meditation that have visualizations, that have, you know, chanting or mantras or such. The type that I practice does not have that. Because with that, you're kind of actually, in a way, distracting yourself again from whatever thoughts are arising, and you're not really building a new relationship with them and learning how to manage them in that way.
Right. And I think that is just of the utmost importance, you know, for anyone developing spiritually, is to be able to, my language may not be the same as yours, but, you know, I think I mean the same thing, to be able to manage your thoughts effectively, so that if they are going to be part of the building blocks of creating your reality, they're going to be the right ones.
Absolutely. And, you know, this book wouldn't exist if I didn't have my practice in place. Because for years I was trying to write, or I was writing, but then I would get to a place where I would listen to the inner critic telling me, oh, this is a piece of crap and you don't do this. And I would just drop, you know, I would self-sabotage over and over and over again. And then when I got a practice into place, and really it was at that time when I started, I couldn't even sit for 3 minutes. But when I got up to maybe 15 minutes or so and I was doing it like regularly, I got to a place where I was able to get a handle on not listening to that voice telling me that it's crap and that I should destroy it and walk away. And then I was able to finish my first, it's a novelette, it's actually not this piece, my first piece on my own. I had prior to that been writing with partners because they were the ones that would be able to, you know, when my voice got really critical, I could pass it over to them and be like, help, you know, like, right, and take a break. But then, you know, on my own, it wasn't until I got the practice in place and started learning how to manage my critical thoughts that I was able to start finishing work. And so I think it's so, so incredibly helpful for writers. Absolutely.
I'm talking to Jennifer Howd, author of Sit, Walk, Don't Talk, How I Survived a Silent Meditation Retreat. And Jennifer, If I don't know too much about your history before this book. I mean, I know you were involved in the industry in L.A. You were a producer. You were a writer. But this is, I think, your first book. And now that the book is written, do you find the part of being a writer, of promoting the book and going out there and doing readings and doing talks to be challenging? Or are you enjoying it?
A little bit of both.
Yeah, that sounds right.
A little bit of both. Yeah, I am both enjoying it. I really love connecting with people about this topic. I just love this topic. I can talk for hours and hours and hours about it. Introducing it to some people, you know, because I know what an amazing impact it had on my life, and potentially if they're interested in it, it could have on theirs as well. And so utilizing the book as a tool to kind of help folks get into the practice, it's fun for me, and talking about it and talking with folks like yourself has been fun too. Yeah. And then there are parts of it that are like, okay, you know, I wrote it a couple years ago. I'm ready to be, you know, thinking and talking about something else.
Ready
now
for the next book. Absolutely. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire. I wish you the best with this book and the one you're working on now.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for joining me for this edition of Words on a Wire. Be mindful, be at peace, and don't let your thoughts drive you crazy. We'll see you next week on Words on a Wire.